From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at Dominican University in the office of librarian Molly Bistrom. She was concerned that too many people were falling for unreliable sources of news. Sound familiar? So Bistrom created a test and she used an acronym to give it a name. Forgive me, but it's known as the CRAP test. C for currency, R for relevance, A for authority, P for purpose. The test helps users evaluate a source of information and ultimately determine whether it's reliable. With all of the talk about so-called fake news, you might assume that the CRAP test is new, but it dates back roughly 10 years, and we're focused on it today because a growing list of American schools is employing this test, or at least some form of it, to help students understand what they're seeing out there in the world. How are students doing with it? Are we raising a generation that is better able to evaluate sources, or have we entered a permanent age of fake news? I hate that phrase, but my guest this hour will help us with this. Let me say hello to Bob Berkman, Business Outreach Librarian at the University of Rochester. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Also here is Sarah White, Adjunct Professor of English at MCC and the College at Brockport, and someone who employs something that's a little more palatable for me to say, the TRAP test, right?
Yes.
The T is what?
Timeliness.
Timeliness, yeah. Okay. I like TRAP better than... Crap. But anyway, thank
Me
you.
Too.
Thanks for
thank
being
you.
Here. Lars Kuehling is Academic Dean for the Harley School. Lars, welcome to you.
Great. Thanks for having us.
And Jossie Kaufman teaches the Rights and Responsibilities class and the Commons at the Harley School. Jossie, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
I want to listen to something that the president said last night, and I'm in sort of a mood today, so let me also just say the sound from this comes from the President of the United States speaking to the Boy Scouts. This was in West Virginia last night. You probably heard of by now some of what he said. And Seneca Waterways, Boy Scouts, can you call me? Can we talk about this? Is everybody okay with this, that the president was talking about his friend who made millions and millions of dollars, bought a yacht, and then implied that there was some drunken debauchery or orgies going on to the Boy Scouts? I mean, what is happening? But anyway, that's not what the sound is about. The sound is from the president last night talking to the Boy Scouts about... What else would the president talk to the Boy Scouts about? Well, he talked about, winning electoral votes and fake news. Let's listen to Donald Trump last night.
Boy, you have a lot of people here. The press will say it's about 200 people. It looks like about 45,000 people. By the way, what do you think the chances are that this incredible, massive crowd, record-setting, is going to be shown on television tonight? 1% or zero? The fake media will say, President Trump spoke, and you know what this is. President Trump spoke before a small crowd of Boy Scouts today. That is some crowd. Fake media, fake news.
No, actually, it was a big crowd. That's the big concern here. There's a lot of people listening to that. And the question becomes then, is the president trying to kind of raise a generation to not trust the media at all? And so before we even get into the so-called CRAP test and things like that and what students are hearing, I just want to get a little bit of reaction here. And this is not politicized right-wing, left-wing, Democrat, Republican. I'm curious to know, I'll start with you, Bob, when the president is telling the next generation, a Boy Scout generation, that the media is not trustable, that everything is fake that you see in the mainstream news, that worries me. Does it worry you?
It worries me incredibly. And the main reason is because, unfortunately, Donald Trump has come to redefine and conflate the term fake news with whatever he disagrees with. Although it's a problematic term to begin with, it did originally mean something. It started, actually, John Stewart used it in a comedic sense, but it meant when last year, when before the election, when they found out that there were some young people in Macedonia creating false, inaccurate information to get high levels of clicks and to get money for the high clicks. Then it became to mean political news that was inaccurate, designed to influence people, that was false. Now, unfortunately, the president has redefined it and blurred it to mean any news that he does not like or does not agree with. So on the one hand, yes, we should always be skeptical and critically thinking about our source of information. But the concept of saying that the media is fake and untrustworthy because it publishes things that he disagrees with or does not like, that does a huge disservice to everybody.
All right. Sarah White, Adjunct Professor of English at MCC and the College at Brockport. You're working with students every day. day. You're getting a sense for how they're getting their news or evaluating. Does that kind of messaging do any damage to you? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I feel like students come into my classroom and, you know, when I see students, they're generally, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old. They've come from their parents' home where maybe a certain philosophy was espoused either way, and then they're in the college classroom dealing with a lot of people with different points of view. And they're just sort of realizing that not everything on the one news channel that's been playing at home forever is correct. Or, you know, they're just sort of, it's like, you know, the light bulb is turning on a little bit. For them. So when you dig a little bit deeper into, okay, let's look at some facts, let's look at some rhetorical devices that many people use, and then they recognize these, you know, common rhetorical devices in, you know, political speeches, it, you know, the light bulb burns even brighter.
Okay. Yeah. All right. There's a little optimism for us there. Lars, how do you feel listening to that clip?
I guess my big concern is at the opportunity for students to become independent thinkers, to learn to work together for a common cause. And I think one of the big concerns that we have at Harley is how can we get students to think independently but also think for a common cause? How are you going to work together to solve some problems? And it feels as if the current situation is one that people are making choices one side or the other. It's a winner-take-all sort of conversation, and people are marshaling facts or non-facts to their own benefit.
Jossie, what do you think?
I appreciated your breakdown of what fake news has meant over time, because honestly, this is my, you know, I'm 26, and so this is really my second big election, and that I have been wholly aware of. And so fake news has sort of like come into my consciousness very recently. And so having that breakdown, because I think I've started to really question what does fake news mean. And so that's something that I think that with my students, we're going to have to do quite a bit of just that very basic, like, especially because I work with ninth graders, what does that even mean? And where does that terminology come from? So I really appreciated that background.
Well, I want to kind of go around the room and let's talk about this test. And we'll get to some of your comments. Listeners, if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We need to be able to raise a generation, every generation of students, to become, you know, sort of well-educated, well-rounded people. Not to all think the same, but to have the skills to evaluate information. You know, that matters for civics, it matters for citizenship. And I want to kind of just go around the table and ask about this test. The CRAP test takes a look at, you know, the different prongs to help students understand. Is the information recent enough for your topic? That's the C, currency. The R is reliability/relevance. Where does the information come from, and does the information apply to your topic? A is authority. Who authored this information? And P is purpose or point of view. What was the intent of the author, and how is the author connected to the information? Now, Sarah White, you used the TRAP test. So instead of currency, you used timeliness. So I like TRAP.
Right. It basically, you know, obviously it means the same thing, but when I was planning out my lessons, I was like, well, I could spend 10 minutes at the beginning of the class having everyone giggle over the word crap, or I could just call it trap and move on with my day.
Yeah, so, that's probably good. Yeah, yeah. but it's the same purpose, the same mission. And then how do you employ this? How do you get them thinking about these sources? Take me through how you kind of do the lessons with students.
Well, honestly, how I like to do it is, you know, so much of research is done online. In fact, probably most of our research is done online, at least for the purposes of my classes, and probably personally as well. So we'll look at different, you know, websites. Well, how can you get this information? You know, when was this published? Who published it? Does this have to do with my topic? So we'll kind of go through those things. But the thing that I've spent the most time on this past year is the P, which stands for purpose. I find that all of the other ones don't matter unless you know for what purpose the information is being put out there. Is it a commercial website? Are they might be giving you information, but are they also selling something? Are they, you know, promoting a political agenda? And sometimes not to say it's necessarily nefarious, but sometimes it's a little tricky to figure out what purpose the information is serving, and having kids try to figure that out, having students try to figure that out is really important.
Okay. So on that P, that's the most important of the acronym for Sarah White. Bob Berkman, as a business outreach librarian at the University of Rochester, who has spent a lot of time working with the evaluation of sources, particularly in this age of social media now and sort of all the way this information can really accelerate out there. What's the most important part for you, especially if you're going to work with young people, to help them understand how do we evaluate this? What's the way to do that?
I think a big part of it now is that although all these checklists and tests are still incredibly valuable, things have changed so rapidly in the last couple of years in terms of non-transparent ways of mimicking what looks to be real news, that we need to almost rethink how we're going to inform students, make them information literate about the algorithmically driven and what's come to be called computational propaganda, the way bots and others are being created. The most of the news has come from the political side, but certainly commercial is going to catch on to this soon because the technology has advanced so quickly that what's coming over social media feeds now, which is what Pew and other researchers show is the most common popular way that students and many of us are receiving our news, that it's becoming increasingly difficult to really dig out what that agenda is. A lot of these sites make things look like normal or traditional feeds that someone might share. They're done by sock puppets, you know, fake users disseminating fake content. And they've got some very sophisticated programmers creating things that are increasingly harder to tell what's real and what isn't real. So I think first is to expose as much as possible the process behind this, so to at least students have the most elegant solution, which I think again is information literacy, understanding how these are created. And the other big part I think these days is the fact that we need to realize that, and there's some good research done on this, that showing people what's factually correct may no longer be the answer. What we're doing today is showing our affinity to the larger group. Now, this is more political, and when we come to scientific and historical, we can look at other ways. But more and more people are choosing to believe almost in a tribalistic manner what supports their pre-existing belief. And facts are secondary, sadly, and they shouldn't be. But we can't just provide the facts alone anymore. Because we're understanding the researcher Judith Donath at MIT has done some great research on how we signal our affinity with a group by what we share, and that we belong to a larger group that think like us. And others have looked at how it's become more a tribalistic view of information rather than a factual. So I think, you know, making students aware of their own internal processes too, and what's going on the scene to manipulate them, has to be added on top of our standard sort of authority checklists.
I want to ask Jossie Kaufman, who, you know, you outed yourself your age here, so you're 26. It wasn't that long ago when you were a student, and now you're evaluating what students are learning. What's the age of the students you're teaching now at Harley?
I teach 13 until 17.
Yeah, right. Okay, so let me just ask a kind of a wide-ranging question first, and then we'll get more specific. How good are students at discerning information and sources right now, when they kind of come into your class?
I think it's a struggle for all of us. I don't know if it's
why limit it to just students?
Yeah, why limit it to just students? I think we all struggle with it. So, I think that they have even more news sources than us, a lot of us, because they're including things like Snapchat and Instagram and all these sites that I would have never considered news sources before are becoming news sources. So I think that makes it, I do think that makes it difficult for them.
And difficult for parents. Parent out there listening who just rolled their eyes at this, understand what Jossie's saying is true, that students are getting their information, whether parents like it or not, from this diversity of sources.
And quite frankly, like when I was in high school and college, I was getting a lot of my news from Facebook. So I mean, that just goes to show how much our definition, I guess, of like what a news source would be is expanding. And so that makes it much challenging for them.
A lot has changed for sure. So how do you help them?
Well, I agree a lot with what Bob was saying. I focus on sort of this point of view perspective. Mm-hmm. And challenging them to really understand who they are and where they're coming from so that we can avoid confirmation bias. I had you come into my classroom, and we talked a lot about what does it mean to be objective and how...
I remember that. I like that.
Yeah.
That was fun.
And how it's impossible. And so really challenging them to, like, if you go into, like, go into reading everything as this is not objective, you're challenging them to identify bias in everything.
Yeah, I think you're quoting me pretty correctly. I think what I said was, you know, human beings are, if your goal is to only follow journalists who are purely objective on everything, you will not find that. What you need to find are people who are self-aware of their own biases so as not to always seek out information, even for journalists, to report on, to only use the quotes. How many inches do you have in an article that you're writing? Are you only using the quotes that might support a bias that you have? If you know you have a bias, you can at least be self-aware and be very careful about that. So I like self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Objectivity is great when you can really feel like that's where you're at. And I always say I'm an evidence person. My mind is always open to change. But I'm a human being, so I want to be self-aware first and foremost. And as consumers of information, students should be self-aware of where their biases may come from so as to help counter some of that. So I like that. But how do they do with it? When you really see them try to start using some of these concepts and making sure what they're trusting or you know, that they're not sort of being duped, how do they do?
I think they do great. And as great as somebody can do for finding out that they're a biased person, I think bias can be seen as like a really dirty word and that you want to make sure that you come off as the least biased person possible, like the least biased person possible when we're setting them up for huge failure with that. And we're setting them up for bad research and within any profession that they go into. So, I think that for finding out that you have bias and working with it, they do really well.
Yeah, I think that's great. For people who think that they have no bias, their purity is amazing. And what scares me is then they stop respecting the quote-unquote other side because they think, well, I'm the one who sees things without bias, and everyone else has a bias, and they don't respect people who may differ. And the goal is always to at least offer some respect unless someone is being sort of hateful or hurtful. But Lars, how about you? You know, how do you think students are doing with this, in this, particularly in this sort of high-velocity information age?
You know, I think students are doing pretty well with it. It's interesting, as Jossie points out, they're so connected through Snapchat and other things that isolate us as adults from their world. That they're not always tuning into the things that we think are meaningful. How many of them read the New York Times, follow Politico, you know, have a Facebook page that they even use where fake news can be pushed at them? So in some ways, I think they circumvent it, which then means we have to meaningfully find ways to engage them in a conversation that brings that outside world to them so that they're not completely isolated from that outside world. Social studies classes, English class, whatnot, great place to do it. I think something Sarah said that really struck me that I made me sort of think about our approach with younger kids is we ask three central questions. You know, is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? And I guess my concern as an educator is in all of this conversation, we keep leaving out the is it kind portion because we're lacking a civility in this conversation around news and fake news. That matters to me. I remember back in the day being amazed as, and I'm a little older than Jossie, being amazed to find out that Ronald Reagan had friends on the Democratic side of the aisle, that they were able to, after a long and contentious debate, be able to still shake hands and find commonality. And that's my preoccupation with kids today. What are we doing to teach them to sort of bury that hatchet, find that level of compromise, and come to find a truth that we know is not 100% reliable, but at least is 95, 98% reliable.
Okay. Let me grab our first phone call. This is Keith in Penfield on the line. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show, but I'm a consummate cynic. I don't get it. If somebody says something or if I read something, if I don't know exactly the truth of it, I will try to verify it. If somebody makes a claim, I want proof of that claim. And so I'm a constant skeptic. Now, on a news feed, if I see the byline, CNN or New York Times or Fox, I might give it a little bit more credence than if it's something I don't recognize. But I think people have to, kids included, especially teenagers, if somebody tells you something and, you know, and there's ramifications if they're wrong, verify it. A lot of people won't, but I go by trust but verify.
But how do you verify, but, Keith? How do you verify?
Well, you could see if there's any corroborating bylines for a story. So, say, okay, Trump hit this girl in a bar in 2001.
Okay, careful. But
all right, or something like that. See if there's any other stories about it. Or just treat it with a little bit of skepticism because you can't verify it. I mean, I can say anything. I can say, well, I saw Donald Trump 2 years ago. Well, let's see the proof of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know? So, Keith, thank you. And I think Keith's comment goes back to what Jossie is saying. If you think that you are not biased, and then you see a story, and you are, by the way, we're all biased, as Jossie said, and then you see a story that might confirm the bias that you claim you don't have, you're more likely to share it without verifying it. And all of a sudden, things really gain velocity. One thing, Jossie, you know, you talk about parents have to understand kids are going to get information from, whether they like it or not, Instagram, Facebook, etc. They're also going to see memes pop up. Sometimes you see one picture and then several bullet points, and it's a really powerful message because things get distilled simply. And the desire is just to retweet that or to repost it and say, look, without verifying it. And that's something that I've probably done. Students probably do that. That's something to really probably flag for students, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we want this group of this generation wants to share. They want to share humor. They want to share their opinion. So certainly.
Okay. And Bob, how do you feel about the verify part? You know, Keith is bringing up the importance of verification.
Well, obviously that's critical. The hard part now, and now I guess now means maybe almost like 15 years or more, but in a sense that we all have to become our own editors, our own verifiers. Before we would rely on our institutional filters, you know, really before social media. And we, you know, for better or worse, and with all their flaws, there was always a level of vetting, and at least there was an attempt to be accurate. Though, of course, you could always criticize any traditional news organization. But now when anybody really is their own publisher or broadcaster, and sometimes it works to the benefit. It allows voices that haven't been heard to be heard before. But at the same time, it means we have to take on the role of almost becoming our own editors, which means having that basic information literacy skills to see if there are corroborating sources, to see if there's been fact-checked organizations, whether it's Snopes or other ones, that have looked at a meme that's circulating. Even Google now, in Google News, they've as the platforms are trying to be a little more responsible here as they're becoming more like pseudo news organizations. Google is putting a bar on the side of their Google News trending questionable sources to help people decide whether they're real or not. But it's really, ultimately, it has to be, you have to know how to analyze, whether it's through one of these crap tests or other tests, or just by understanding how information is created, to think like a journalist and an editor, so you can go out there and do a little verification on your own, especially before sharing something and helping make viral something that isn't correct. So we all have that extra burden, but it's also a good thing that we're skeptical and we need to do that work.
Before I get back to your phone calls, I would just add as well, one thing that I would want students to understand is, you know, we talk about clickbait and things like that. Headlines don't always match the story. And what people often remember is the headline. I'll give you an example. Last week on the program, we sat down with Dr. Gregory Vincent, the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And we spoke about the fact that Dr. Vincent was at the University of Texas as their diversity, essentially the director of diversity programs at UT. And so he was very involved with the case that went all the way to the Supreme Court regarding affirmative action. Justice Scalia, before his passing, made some remarks in that case that Dr. Vincent told us on the program last week he thought were racist. But here's the headline from CNN. The headline is this: Supreme Court releases audio of Justice Antonin Scalia saying maybe black students don't belong at elite universities. That is not what Scalia said. Now, Scalia did say that black students who can only get into elite universities through affirmative action might be disserved by it. And that is still debatable. And even that is what Dr. Vincent said is still, to him, has some racist undertones. But he's not saying that black students don't belong in elite universities. And that headline alone, I don't know if the headline writer was the author. Usually it's not. But that's what people take away from it. So you're looking at what CNN reports, but you might only read the headline. And you got to be careful. And I would always teach students, make sure the headline matches the article. And don't share anything if you haven't read it. I had to do that myself, by the way. I've caught myself sharing something, half reading it, and later going, whoops. And I've pledged I'm not going to do that anymore. And that CNN story is a good example of why I don't want to do that. Sarah, you want to weigh in on more on sort of how you work with students on, again, evaluating whether it's headline, article, you know, sorting through how murky things get here. Tell me more about how you address it in class.
Yeah, I mean, I use a lot of, like, real-world, real-time examples. Like, you know, I'll get the smart board up, and we'll just go to Google, and we'll Google stuff and see what types of things that come up. I actually brought one with me today.
Perfect. Let's do it.
Right after the – so there is so much to talk about in classes right after the election. So much. So one of the things that I Googled with my students, okay, how to talk to your children about the election results. That's like, you know, something that probably a lot of people Googled and came up with, you know, 4 million results. The first one was CNN, second one today.com, third result theonion.com. So, you know, and I, you know, known this in advance, obviously. So we're going through the sources and we're reading the, you know, the snippet. And I said, okay, read these. And if you were going to, you know, get information from one of these sources that you think would be helpful if you want to talk to your children about this, which, you know, which one do you think would be good? And they're reading through. And I mean, you know, these are, we think of college students as adults, and they are, but they're not in some ways. And many of them were like, oh, here, let's click on this one, The Onion. And then, you know, the first, you know, bullet point in the actual article, and the article looks like, you know, it has a stock photo of a mom and her son, and it looks legit-ish. And the first bullet point has, you know, several curse words in it and refers to, like, giving your child alcoholic beverages, and clearly not a reliable news source. And that confused them. They were like, but I Googled
it. But it looks real.
Yeah, but it looks real. So I feel like that was sort of, once you start doing that and do a couple examples like that, it sort of, it plants the seed of like, oh, you know, just because it comes up on Google and it's exactly what I searched for, that doesn't mean it's a relevant source of information. It doesn't mean that it has the authority to give me information about the source.
Mm-hmm. And maybe producer Megan Mack can help me. I'm almost certain a sitting member of Congress has shared an Onion story thinking it was real to help bolster their viewpoint.
I think that's
so right. It's not just students out there who might need to take Sarah's class. It might be sitting members of Congress. Let me grab Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I think part of the problem with all this is the fact that advocacy journalism has kind of killed the credibility of the press. It has a heavy hand now in guiding what the press reports and what it doesn't report. It's kind of an oxymoron. Locally, if you look at, you know, the newspaper, just looking back at the Fast Ferry fiasco that we had, when the press puts itself in a position where it's cheerleading an initiative, it loses the ability to look at it objectively. And if you saw that early in the game, you would have, if you actually rode the thing very early on, you would have seen it was going to be a massive failure. There just wasn't nearly the crowd count for that. More recent example is the poverty initiative. Press in town has been pushing that for a number of years. So are they really in a position to question it and question where the money's being spent? I think that they've backed off.
Robert, thanks for the phone call. A couple of things, and I'll let the panel chew on this, which is that, number one, on the poverty initiative, I see the press, the local press, as less pushing that in the way Robert says. I understand his point. I mean, I think local journalists are human beings, and they want to see poverty reduced, and they want to see good faith efforts at that. But I don't know too many journalists who are just pushing it blindly. You know, we had the executive director of the poverty initiative, the anti-poverty initiative, on this program, and I thought we asked him on this program every question that comes up when it comes to transparency, following the money, understanding where it goes and what it is used and not for, and then it's up to our listeners to decide if they're satisfied with that. On the subject of the Fast Ferry, I understand that very well. I mean, there were news anchors who wore tuxedos and rode on the ferry and It was a lot of pageantry. And I think, again, that's because there are human beings in the local news media who want certain things to succeed, but there are times where you've got, your job has to entail being a skeptic, a healthy skeptic, and asking hard questions and making sure things are vetted. So I guess I take that point, but let me just go around the table and ask Bob, I'll start with you. Advocacy journalism in general, he's saying, is there more advocacy journalism now? If we really peel back on Walter Cronkite, was he the perfect unbiased person that a lot of people sort of elevate him to?
Well, I think the issue really, it's always been the issue, I mean, it's an old issue about, you know, whether this news report is giving it to you straight or not. And there's always, although like we've said, there's no such thing as objectivity, there's always been an attempt to be fair. Most journalists have tried to be fair. The problem is with the internet and social media and the way we get our news today, there's been the blurring of the boundaries of what is kind of, what is supposed to be straight reporting with the objective of being fair and clear and not having an opinion, and politically tinged news and reporting. I mean, it started with the cable networks, now online, where people are just posting their opinions and thoughts. So everything is mixed all in one vat. So it becomes harder for the user, the reader, the viewer, to discern what is the purpose of this individual piece of reporting. Is it opinion? Is it news? Again, it comes back, I think, ultimately to information literacy. People have to understand why there's different origins. When you do a Google search, you get it all mixed together. We don't have the clear delineations, editorial, or even news analysis like we used to have on the front of the New York Times versus the straight news pages. Again, you could criticize and be critical of where sometimes a news report, you'd say, well, this really wasn't a fair way to treat the issue, but at least there was the attempt, and as a receiver of that information, you knew what was what. It's much harder now to discern what's what online, and that's where, again, we have to take on the burden as the readers and viewers of really understanding and digging in what it is we're getting. So from that standpoint, I'd agree with the caller. I might question, you know, the notion. I think you'd have to look at case by case and say, you know, why do you see this article as advocating, is just reporting on something advocating? That gets into larger journalistic issues that are interesting, but I think the real problem now is just mixing everything in a big vat.
And when it comes to modern advocacy journalism, certainly there are news outlets on the right and left that are pretty proudly proclaiming certain kinds of advocacy. Maybe you read Mother Jones, Leans Left. Maybe you know, various publications. Maybe you watch Sinclair Broadcasting. I mean, there's a lot of advocacy in that kind of broadcasting. So, it gets more complicated, I guess. But there's, I don't disagree with Robert that there is a fair amount of advocacy journalism out there. He thinks it's to the detriment of the public.
There is, and I would just say that as long as you're aware and there's not an intent to deceive or be non-transparent, that's fine. When I watch MSNBC or I watch Fox, I know what I'm getting. I can, as a receiver, see it through that lens, and I can understand the content, and I can respect or challenge something in my own mind. But when someone does something inappropriately, and you did bring up Sinclair, I know there have been some criticisms that Sinclair will often require its local news stations, one of which is owned here in Rochester, to broadcast a piece as part of the local news, which primarily reflects the political, which is on the right when it comes to Sinclair generally, point of view. And the viewer may not be aware of the origin of that source, just mixed in with the local news. So I think advocacy journalism, as long as it's labeled, as long as it's clear, as long as people are still doing good reporting, fact-based, investigative, well-researched, that's fine. That's fine. But it's when we are not aware of what it is, or there's not clarity on where the source comes from, that's when there's a disconnect mm-hmm. in the viewer's, reader's mind, and that's where people can be misled.
Okay. Lars, any concern on advocacy versus, you know, what we would call more objective journalism?
I think our caller, two callers ago, pointed out the notion that people have to be skeptical. One of the things that our seventh grade math teacher does with kids is he shows them graphs from news channels. So he says, here's some images, and here are how you know, Fox News is projecting this, or how CNN is putting this up here. What do you see? And it takes the kids a while to unpack it, because they just look at the data and they say, oh, those are numbers. A case that he gave was a presentation of how welfare ranks supposedly grew during the time of Obama. And he showed them the graph that came right off the news channel, and it had what looked to be a huge disparity between welfare recipients prior to Obama and welfare recipients under Obama. And then he said, notice that they cut off the bottom part of the graph. How did that distort the representation of the growth of welfare? And all of a sudden, the students looked at it differently. Said, we thought we were just looking at numbers. We thought that it was very clear and that it had doubled or whatever the case was. He said, it hadn't. But the presentation of the image that's out there makes a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So even within, as we look at sort of mainstream media, whether it be, you know, commonly accepted to be outside of that group of advocates, there are problems with the way in which news is presented. And you get back to that idea of how skeptical do we want to be as a society? How skeptical do we need to be? I love the fact that he's doing that with kids because they say something that they think is on face value, something that you take, numbers, stats, and they begin to look at it differently.
By the way, producer Megan Mack informs me it was Representative John Fleming of Louisiana who shared an Onion story about Planned Parenthood in 2012 before having to be told the Onion is not a real source of news. On Twitter, Caleb says, but Evan, the Onion is truly satirical. It is not emblematic of the problem of fake news. Here's where I understand the point you're making, Caleb, but here's why I like what Sarah White did with that. You know that it's satirical. Students may encounter it for the first time and say, well, that looks has all the trappings of real news. And then when they read it, yes, they sort of figure it out. But what Sarah is showing them is the extreme side of it. Then the next lesson is it doesn't always get that obvious. It's sort of a sliding scale, and it's easy to dress it up to look real. It's not always the Onion that a student will encounter, not realizing that it's not a really verifiably objective or objective, maybe the wrong word, trustworthy source of information. And when you show them the extreme one, and then you help them start, okay, it's not always going to be the Onion, but it may often have this dressed up this way. Anyway, that's how I took that lesson. Fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where we start with something like that, that once you see it, it's obvious, but then you need to dig in a little bit more and see where it gets a little bit more insidious. I mean, as you know, I'm, you know, someone with a little bit of experience in commercial website ownership. You do have to think about, even if the writer is in good faith writing what they know, it could be a commercial endeavor. They could be trying to get clicks and ad revenue. And, you know, so there's a lot of factors that go into the authority of, you know, sources that you find.
We are way late for our only break. I'm going to come back. No, that's not your fault, Sarah. I'm the guy who's running this ship here. Mary in Shortsville will come into you after our break. We'll take more listener comments as we talk about educating the next generation of students to understand what is real news versus fake news. I am to the point where I'm sort of with Bob. I think that has just been co-opted so much by this White House and many others that it almost has no meaning. But the point is raising students to make sure that they are evaluating at least verifiable information and they're not sharing information that is obviously agenda-based or fake or planted. So let's get that only break and come right back to your phone calls here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the next Doctor Who on the BBC is going to be a woman. The first woman, the 13th Doctor, is Jodie Whittaker. That was a big announcement from the BBC earlier this month, and a lot of celebrating, but also some backlash from people who are saying the Doctor Who can't be a woman, the same people who say James Bond can't be a black man. You know, most of it seems silly, but we're going to explore what it says about our culture next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's go to Mary in Shortsville next on the phone. Go ahead, Mary.
Hey, Evan. So I wanted to comment on the advocacy journalism that was mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a nonprofit, the Borgen Project, out in Seattle, and so the Fight Global Poverty. So we do have a mission statement. We do try to get legislation passed that helps fight global poverty. And I write articles to educate kind of the general public on the topics. I think just because we kind of have goals and hopes as journalists, it doesn't necessarily make us biased. For me, I kind of fish out articles that are relevant. However, sometimes the facts don't support my opinions, and there have been a few times I've just had to drop article topics because I'm not going to bend facts to say this is how poverty is impacting the world. So I just want to say, like, I'm hoping all the good journalists are doing this in May, just because you're working towards a mission doesn't mean you can't still be objective in your mission.
Yeah, Mary, thank you. I mean, I think that is such an important point here. Nothing wrong with having things you believe in, and if you're going to be an advocacy journalist, as Bob said, as long as people understand your mission there, but you still have to fight within, not to just grab onto whatever makes that mission look good if it's not verifiable. And I really appreciate that disposition that you take there, Mary, because we're all better off for that. I mean, that would extend to a lot of different spheres. I want to ask our panel something about expertise. During the brief break, Bob Berkman brought this up, so I'll start with Bob, but I want everybody to kind of weigh in on this, because especially I want to hear from Jossie and Sarah, what students, if we're trusting experts less, or has the internet and sort of social media made everybody think that they're the expert? You know, Bob, Tom Nichols is a writer who I cite often, whose book is The Death of Expertise, and I highly recommend it. And he is a conservative who is nonetheless willing, I think, to be as objective as he can be and intellectually honest as he can be. And he's frustrated that it seems like people now just say, well, my opinion has to carry equal weight. And then they will share anything that builds up their point of view, even if it's contradicted by the so-called experts. And Nichols is really put off by this. He sees it as a modern trend that is really insidious to the American discourse. How do you view it?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. I like Daniel P. Moynihan's quote, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own set of facts. So I think on the one hand, yes, because we've become distrustful of our institutions, our traditional source of authority, whether it's medical, financial, educational, religious, we've had a healthy distrust of authority, which is a little bit different than expertise. Unfortunately, it spills over because people have been upset about what the authority has done or what the elite has done. It's turned, unfortunately, to a distrust of expertise, which is different than authority. And so, for example, in matters of science, I think we still have to rely on our best gauge, which is scientific consensus. Scientific consensus can change. There may be dissension within that. But when it comes to matters of science, I still think we have to go with scientific consensus, whether it's climate change or vaccinations or any other hot button issues. Now, at the same time, though, I think it's good to think the fact that there are a lot of voices that have not been able to be heard that can share useful anecdotal information that does not necessarily have to be discounted. We just have to be careful. There are a lot of health and medical support groups that people can say, hey, this really helped me with my back operation. And it's great to get that because it's like talking to several trusted friends at once. There is a wisdom of crowds phenomena also that unfortunately gets lumped into when people say, well, I don't want to believe the wisdom of crowds. Crowds are stupid. But at the same time, James Surowiecki, who wrote the book The Wisdom of Crowds, showed where it's a mathematical question where large groups under the right circumstances can do better than an individual expert. It's under very narrow circumstances. It's not a matter of fact. It's a matter of things like guessing how many jelly beans are in this jar or who's most likely to win this next election, like a prediction market. So there's a lot going on because the internet has unleashed, in a sense, everybody. And it's good that we all do and can share our opinions, but we just need to and it's great to get, because in a democracy, we want people to share that. But we want to make sure we understand that opinions are not facts, and that we want to come to a determination on what we believe, especially with scientific. We have to look at scientific methods, consensus. Again, then that raises another interesting issue, when do you believe the outliers? Because, of course, scientific consensus changes. And again, ultimately, it comes down to what I've said previously, information literacy. I think when you understand these concepts, you know when to apply what. When you're looking at a piece of information, is this a scientific matter that should go to consensus? Is it an outlier? If so, how do I evaluate the outlier? Is it an opinion? That's fine, but let's hear why you have this opinion. Is it an established fact? So there's just a lot going on. And unfortunately, politics has intruded, and politics has made some people not trust scientific consensus because it doesn't agree with their opinion, or they're afraid of the ramification of saying, yes, if I believe in, let's say, climate change, there's going to be more regulations and I don't like regulations. So we got a lot going on here. And again, that just speaks to the need of my colleagues here of teaching students and the rest of us how to really make sense of all this and how to understand things properly.
Sarah White, adjunct professor of English at MCC and the College of Brockport, do your students feel like their voice deserves equal weight, or are they understanding the A in the crap or trap test, which is authority, and that they may have an opinion, but there is also experts who have a lot more experience than they do in understanding that they do?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question, because I don't think it's necessarily that they trust experts more or less than anyone ever has. I think it's that everyone is an expert, and it's hard to suss out. And it really does take some investigative skills to figure out who is actually an expert. You know, are there peer-reviewed studies, you know, that come to this conclusion? Or is it this one person in their Instagram feed claiming that this happened? You know what I mean? There's not a lot of differentiation in terms of, you know, airtime that either of these sources get. And in fact, most people I know spend less time with the, you know, peer-reviewed studies than they do their Instagram feed. So, you know, it's not necessarily a matter of trusting more or less. It's, you know, everyone positing themselves as an expert, mm-hmm. and the onus then being on the individual to make those determinations.
Okay. Jossie Kaufman teaches the Rights and Responsibilities class in the Commons at the Harley School. Thoughts on this subject?
Yeah, expert is a loaded word, and I think that I agree a lot with what Sarah's saying of like, and I also want to teach my students how to, in those cases of oppressed groups, how do we make sure that we're finding those voices, because they may not have had the opportunity to be expert, and also working with a group of youth, and how do we how do we make sure that their voices are being heard when they're, because a lot, you know, like I think there are a lot of people who would claim to be sort of experts on adolescence, and but they live the experience, and so I think that it's also, you know, like how do you balance that? How do you balance between the expert because they've done the review, you know, they've written the peer reviews, and they. And they work with all these people in their fields that are excellent. And then how do you also say, because I think there's also sometimes there's the people who delve too much into the expert and then miss all these other voices like we've been talking about. So it's something that I, you know, struggle to make sure I balance.
Okay. And Lars, thoughts on expertise?
But listening to Jossie talk here, you know, I think one of the things that we have done in some ways is to throw away some of the common sources of expertise. And for instance, we completely redid our history curriculum and got rid of the textbook-based type of curriculum where, yes, the textbooks were written by experts, but they were verified by, you know, the Board of Education in Texas and in California, which pretty much drove the conversation around what would get presented. Instead, we moved to a position where students read and wrestled with original works, and they'd be presented with two different points of view, whether it be two political points of view or two people's firsthand accounts of what happened in history. And then from there, they were asked or are asked to begin to draw out something that represents what would be truthful. You know, with Jossie and I happened to work with her in the Rights and Responsibilities course. Kids cannot take the easy way out in finding information. Wikipedia is not a source for us. It's a great way to find out some information, but man, you got to be careful with what's out there. So instead, we ask them to have multiple sources, and we ask them to actually get out in the field and talk with people who have personal knowledge.
I think that's a great point. And Bob, we got about 30 seconds.
Okay.
So go ahead.
I just want to mention that one of the major library associations, ACRL, they redefine their information literacy framework, which they do every some number of years. In the most recent major overhaul, they looked at authority, and they've decided that authority is constructed and contextual, which means we're not getting rid of it. We just need to think more carefully about how we determine who counts as an authority.
Well, this is a conversation that will go on. In fact, before we even get back to school, we're hoping to have another conversation on media literacy, whether there will be simply more media literacy classes in local schools in K-12, the college level. Dana Goldstein now writes for the New York Times. She wrote a great piece for Slate this past winter on media literacy, and we're going to revisit that, and we'll hit that before we go back to school. But thanks to our entire panel, Bob Berkman, Business Outreach Librarian at the U of R. Great having you. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Evan.
From the Harley School, Jossie Kaufman, Lars Kuehling, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Sarah White, Adjunct Professor of English at MCC and the College of Brockport. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
And maybe we'll post some of her slides, and you can see how you would do if you were a student in Sarah's classes. So, a short break. Much more Connections next.